Standing there, her commander crosses her arms. The girl doesn't flinch. Then I see the commander step forward. When the girl starts to protest, she pushes her aside. "You can't stay there forever!" the commander shouts up at me. Her voice is much colder than the girl's. "And I know you won't leave your family to die!" I fit the last bullet into my slingshot and point it straight at her. The commander shakes her head at my silence. "Okay, Eparis," she says to the girl. "We've tried your tactic. Now let's try mine." She turns to the dark-haired captain and nods once. "Cap her!" I have no time to stop what happens next. The captain lifts his gun and points it at my mother. Then he shoots her in the head.
June. The woman Thomas shoots hasn't even crumpled to the ground yet when I see the boy launch himself from the rooftop. I freeze. This is all wrong. No one's supposed to get hurt. Commander Jameson did not tell me that she intended to kill anyone from the house. We were supposed to take them all back to Batala Hall for arrest and questioning. My eyes dart to Thomas, wondering if he feels the same horror I do. But he remains expressionless, his gun still drawn. "Get him!" Commander Jameson yells out. The boy lands on one of the soldiers and knocks him to the ground in a shower of dirt. "We're taking him alive!" The boy, who I now know is Day, lets out a wrenching scream and charges at the nearest soldier even as they close in around him. Somehow he manages to get a hold of the soldier's gun, although another soldier instantly knocks it from his hands. Commander Jameson looks at me and pulls the pistol from her belt. "Commander, don't!" I blurt out, but she ignores me. Mateus flashes through my mind. "I'm not going to wait for him to kill off my soldiers!" she snaps back at me. Then she aims at Day's left leg and fires. I wince. The bullet misses its mark. She was aiming for his kneecap. But it hits the flesh of his outer thigh. Day lets out a scream of agony, then goes down amidst a circle of soldiers. The cap flips off his head. His blonde hair spills out from beneath it. One soldier kicks him hard enough to knock him out. Then they cuff him, blindfold and gag him, and drag him into one of the waiting jeeps. It takes me a moment to turn my attention to the other prisoner we pulled from the house, a young man who's probably Day's brother or cousin. He's screaming something unintelligible at us. The soldiers shove him into the second jeep. Thomas gives me an approving look over his mask, but Commander Jameson just frowns at me. "I can see why Drake labeled you a troublemaker," she says. "This isn't college. You don't question my actions." A part of me wants to apologize, but I'm too overwhelmed by what just happened, too angry or anxious or relieved. What about our plan? Commander, with all due respect, we didn't discuss killing civilians. Commander Jameson lets out a sharp laugh. "Oh, Eparis," she replies. "We'd be here all night if we kept negotiating. See how much faster that was? Much more persuasive to our target." She looks away. "No matter. Time for you to get in a jeep, back to headquarters." She makes a quick motion with her hand, and Thomas barks out an order. The other soldiers hurry back into their formations. She climbs into the first jeep. Thomas approaches, then tips his hat at me. "Congratulations, June." He smiles. "I think you really did it. What a run. Did you see the look on Day's face?" "You just murdered someone." I can't bring myself to look at Thomas. Can't bring myself to ask him how he can bear to follow orders so blindly. My eyes wander to where the woman's body lies on the pavement. Medics have already surrounded the three wounded soldiers, and I know they'll be placed carefully in the medic truck and taken back to headquarters. But the woman's body lies unattended and abandoned. A few heads peek out at us from the other houses along the street. Some of them see the body and quickly turn away, while others keep a timid gaze on Thomas and me. Some small part of me wants to smile at the sight, to feel the joy of avenging my brother's death. I pause, but the feeling doesn't come. My hands clench and unclench. The pool of blood underneath the woman is starting to make me feel sick. "Remember," I tell myself, "Day killed Mateus. Day killed Mateus. Day killed Mateus. The words echo empty and uncertain in my mind. Yeah, I say to Thomas. My voice sounds like a stranger's. I think I really did it.
Part 2. The Girl Who Shatters the Shining Glass. Day. The world's a blur. I remember guns and loud voices, and the splash of ice water over my head. Sometimes I recognize the sound of a key turning in a lock and the metallic smell of blood. Gas masks look down at me. Somebody won't stop screaming. There's a medic truck siren wailing all the time. I want to turn it off, and I keep trying to find its switch, but my arms feel weird. I can't move them. A horrible pain in my left leg keeps my eyes and cheeks moist with tears. Maybe my entire leg's wasted. The moment the captain shot my mother plays over and over in my head, like a movie stuck on the same scene. I don't understand why she doesn't move out of the way. I yell at her to move, to duck, to do anything. But she just stays there until the bullet hits her and she crumples to the ground. Her face is pointed right at me. But it's not my fault. It's not. The blurring comes into focus after an eternity. What's it been, 4 or 5 days? A month, maybe? I have no idea. When I finally open my eyes, I see that I'm now in a small, windowless cell with 4 steel walls. Soldiers stand on either side of a small, vault-like door. I grimace. My tongue is cracked and bone dry. Tears have dried against my skin. Something that feels like metal cuffs binds my hands tightly to the back of a chair, and it takes me a second to realize that I'm sitting. My hair hangs over my face in stringy ribbons. Blood stains my vest. A sudden fear seizes me. My cap! I'm exposed! Then I feel the pain in my left leg. It's worse than anything I've ever experienced, worse even than the first time I got cut in that knee. I break out in a cold sweat and see stars flicker in the corners of my vision. At that moment, I would give anything for a painkiller, or ice to put out the fire in my injured thigh, or even another bullet to put me out of my misery. Tess, I need you. Where are you? When I dare to look down at my leg, though, I see that it's wrapped in a tight, blood-soaked bandage. One of the soldiers notices me stirring. He presses his hand against his ear. He's awake, ma'am. Minutes later, maybe it's hours, the metal door swings open and the commander who ordered my mother's death strides in. She has her full uniform on, cloak and all, and her triple arrow insignia shines silver under the fluorescent lights. Electricity. I'm in a government building. She says something to the soldiers on the other side of the door, then it swings shut again, and she saunters over to me with a smile. I'm not sure if the red haze clouding my vision is because of the pain from my leg or my rage at her presence. The commander stops in front of my chair, then leans down, close to my face. My dear boy, she says. I can hear the amusement in her voice. I was so excited when they told me you were awake. I just had to come and see you myself. You should feel pretty lucky. The medics say you're plague-free, even after spending time with that infected lot you call a family. I jerk back and spit at her. Even this movement is enough to make my leg tremble from white, hot pain. What a beautiful boy you are. She gives me a smile laced with poison. A pity you chose the life of a criminal. You could have become a celebrity in your own right, you know, with a face like that. Free plague vaccinations every year. Wouldn't that have been nice? I could tear the skin off her face right now if I weren't tied up. Where are my brothers? My voice comes out as a hoarse croak. What have you done with Eden? The commander just smiles again and snaps her fingers at the soldiers behind her. Believe me when I say I would love to stay and chat with you, but I have a training session to lead. There's also a person much more eager to see you than I am. I'll let her take it from here. The commander exits without another word. Then I see someone else, someone smaller with a more delicate frame, enter the cell with a swoosh of a black cape. It takes me a minute to recognize her. No more torn trousers or muddy boots, no dirt on her face. The girl is clean and polished, her dark hair pulled back into a high, glossy ponytail. She wears a fancy uniform. Gold epaulettes shine from the top of her cloaked military robe. White ropes loop around her shoulders, and a double arrow insignia is printed on both sleeves. Her cape hangs all the way to her feet, swathing her in gold-trimmed black. An elaborate kanto knot holds the top of her robes firmly in place. I'm surprised at how young she looks, even younger than when I first met her. Surely the Republic wouldn't give a girl my age such a high rank. I look at her mouth. The same lips I kissed are now coated in a light sheen of gloss. A cracked thought hits me and I want to laugh. If she had not led to the death of my mother and my capture, if I did not wish she were dead, I would find her absolutely breathtaking. She must have seen the recognition on my face. You must be as thrilled as I am to meet again. Call it an act of extreme kindness that I requested your leg be bandaged up, she snaps. I want to see you stand for your execution, and I won't have you dying from infection before I'm through with you.
Thanks. You're very kind.
She ignores my sarcasm. So, your day then. I stay silent. The girl crosses her arms and regards me with a penetrating glare. I suppose I should call you Daniel, though. Daniel Alton Wing. I managed to get that much out of your brother John. At the mention of John's name, I lean forward and instantly regret it as my leg explodes in pain.
Tell me where my brothers are.
Her expression doesn't change. She doesn't even blink.
They are no longer your concern.
She takes several steps forward. Here she has a precise, deliberate step, unmistakably that of the Republic's elite. She disguised it surprisingly well on the streets. It only makes me angrier.
Here's how it works, Mr. Wing. I'm going to ask you a question, and you're going to give me an answer. Let's start with an easy one. How old are you?
I meet her gaze.
I should have never saved you from that skiz fight. I should have left you to die.
The girl looks down, then takes a gun from her belt and strikes me hard across the face. For a second I can see only blinding white light. The taste of blood fills my mouth. I hear something click, then feel cold metal against my temple.
Wrong answer. Let me be clear. You give me another wrong answer, and I'll make sure you can hear your brother John's screams all the way from here. You give me a third wrong answer, and your little brother, Eden, can share the same fate.
John and Eden. At least they're both still alive. Then I realize from the hollow sound of her gun's click that her gun isn't loaded. Apparently she just wants to slap me around with it. The girl doesn't move her gun away.
How old are you?
15.
That's better.
The girl lowers her gun a little.
Time for a few confessions. Were you responsible for the break-in at the Arcadia Bank?
The 10-second place.
Yes.
Then you must be responsible for stealing 16,500 notes from there as well.
You got that right.
Were you responsible for vandalizing the Department of Intra-Defense 2 years ago and destroying the engines of 2 warfront airships?
Yes.
Did you set fire to a series of 10 F-472 fighter jets parked at the Burbank Air Force Base right before they were to head out to the warfront?
I'm kind of proud of that one.
Did you assault a cadet standing guard at the edge of the Alta Sector's quarantine zone?
I tied him up and delivered food to some quarantine families. Bite me.
The girl rattles off a few more past offenses, some of which I can barely remember. Then she names one more crime. My latest.
Were you responsible for the death of a city patrol captain during a raid on the Los Angeles Central Hospital? Did you steal medical supplies and break into Floor 3?
I lift my chin.
The captain named Mateus.
She gives me a cold look.
That's right. My brother.
So, this is why she hunted me down. I take a deep breath.
Your brother. I didn't kill him. I couldn't have. Unlike you, trigger-happy trots, I don't kill people.
The girl doesn't reply. We stare at each other for a moment. I feel a weird tinge of sympathy and quickly push it away. I can't feel sorry for a Republic agent. She motions to one of the soldiers standing by the door.
The prisoner in 6822. Cut off his fingers.
I lunge forward, but my cuffs and the chair stop me. My knee explodes with pain. I'm not used to someone having this much power over me.
Yes, I was responsible for breaking in, I shout. But I'm serious when I tell you that I didn't kill him. I admit I hurt him. Yes, I had to escape and he tried to stop me. But there's no way my knife throw could have caused anything more than a wounded shoulder. Please, I'll answer your questions. I've given you answers to everything so far.
The girl looks at me again. Nothing more than a wounded shoulder? Maybe you should have double-checked. There's a deep fury in her eyes, something that takes me aback. I try to remember the night I faced Mateus. The moment when he had his gun pointed at me and I had my knife pointed at him. I'd thrown it at him. It had hit his shoulder. I'm sure of it. Am I? After a moment, she tells the soldier to hold off.
According to the Republic's databases, she goes on, Daniel Alton Wing died 5 years ago from smallpox, in one of our labor camps.
I snort at that. Labor camps. Yeah, right. And the elector is fairly elected every term, too. This girl either actually believes all that made-up crap, or she's taunting me. An old memory struggles to resurface. A needle injected into one of my eyes. A cold metal gurney and an overhead light. But it vanishes as soon as it comes.
Daniel is dead, I reply. I left him behind a long time ago.
That was when you began your little crime spree on the streets, I guess. 5 years? Seems like you grew used to getting away with things. Started letting your guard down, didn't you? Did you ever work for anybody? Did anybody ever work for you? Were you ever affiliated with the Patriots?
I shake my head. A terrifying question emerges in my mind. A question I'm too afraid to bring up. What has she done with Tess?
No. They've tried recruiting me before, but I prefer to work alone.
How did you escape the labor camps? How did you end up terrorizing Los Angeles when you should have been working for the Republic?
So this is what the Republic thinks of children who fail the trial.
What does it matter? I'm here now.
This time I strike some sort of nerve with the girl. She kicks my chair back until it can go no further, then slams my head against the wall. Stars burst across my vision.
I'll tell you why it matters, she hisses. It matters because if you hadn't escaped, my brother would be alive right now. And I want to make sure no other filthy street con assigned to the labor camps escapes the system, so that this scenario won't play out ever again.
I laugh in her face. The pain in my knee only fuels my anger.
Oh, is that all you're worried about? A bunch of renegade trial takers who managed to escape their deaths? Those 10-year-olds are a dangerous bunch, yeah? I'm telling you that you got your facts wrong. I didn't kill your brother. But you killed my mother. You might as well have held the gun to her head.
The girl's face hardens, but behind that I can see something waver, if only for a moment. And she looks like the girl I'd met on the streets. She leans over me, so close that her lips touch my ear, and I can feel her breath against my skin. A shiver runs down my spine. She lowers her voice to a whisper that only I can hear.
I'm sorry about your mother.
My commander had promised me she wouldn't hurt any civilians, and she went back on her word. Her voice quivers. She actually sounds a little apologetic, like that will help.
I wish I could have stopped Thomas.
You and I are enemies, make no mistake about that. But I did not wish for such a thing to happen. Then she straightens and begins to turn away.
That'll do for now. Wait.
With great effort, I swallow my temper and clear my throat. The question I'd been afraid to think about escapes before I can stop it.
Is she alive? What did you do with her?
The girl glances back at me. The expression on her face tells me she knows exactly who I'm talking about. Tess. Is she alive? I brace myself for the worst. But instead, the girl just shakes her head.
I don't know. I have no interest in her.
She nods at one of the soldiers.
Withhold water from him for the rest of the day and move him to a cell at the end of the hall. Maybe he'll be less temperamental in the morning.
It's weird to see the soldier salute someone so young. She's keeping Tess a secret, I realize. For my sake? For Tess's sake? Then the girl's gone, and I'm left alone in the cell with the soldiers. They haul me off the chair, across the floor, and out the door. My bad leg drags along the tiles. I can't hold back the tears that spring to my eyes. The pain makes me lightheaded, like I'm drowning in a bottomless lake. The soldiers are taking me down a wide hallway that seems to be a mile long. Troops are everywhere, along with doctors wearing goggles and white gloves. I must be in the medical ward, probably because of my leg. My head slumps forward. I can't hold it up anymore. In my mind, I see the image of my mother's face as she lies crumpled on the ground. I didn't do it, I want to scream, but no sound comes out. The pain of my wounded leg reclaims me. At least Tess is safe. I try to send a mental warning to her, to tell her to get out of California and run as far as she can. That's when, halfway down the hall, something catches my attention. A small red number, a zero, printed in the same style as the ones I'd seen underneath the porch of our house and under the banks of our sector's lake. It's here. I turn my head to get a better look as we pass the double doors it's sprayed on. The doors have no windows, but a gas-masked figure clad in white enters and I get a brief glimpse inside. I don't see much more than blurs as we walk by, but I do manage to catch one thing. Something in a bag on a gurney. A body. On the bag is a red X. Then the doors slide shut again and we continue on. A series of images begin to run through my mind. The red numbers, the three-lined X mark on my family's door, the medic trucks that took Eden away. Eden's eyes, black and bleeding. They want something from my little brother. Something to do with his illness. I picture the three-line X again. What if it was no accident that Eden got the plague? What if it's no accident when anyone gets it?
June. That evening, I forced myself into a dress to attend an impromptu ball with Thomas on my arm. The gala is being held to celebrate the capture of a dangerous criminal, and to reward us all for bringing him to justice. Soldiers go out of their way to hold open doors for me when we arrive. Others throw me salutes. Clusters of chatting officials smile at me when I pass, and my name is scattered through almost every conversation I overhear. That's the Aparis girl. She looks awfully young. Only 15 years old, my friend. The Elector himself is impressed. Some words are more heavily laced with envy than others. Not as big a deal as you might think. Truly, it's Commander Jameson that deserves the recognition. Just a child. No matter their tone, though, the topic is me. I try to take pride in all this. I even tell Thomas, as we wander the lavish ballroom with its endless banquet tables and chandeliers, that arresting day has filled the gaping hole Mateus's death left in my life. But even as I say it, I don't believe it. Everything here feels wrong somehow. Everything about this room, as if it's all an illusion that will shatter if I reach out and touch it. I feel wrong, like I did a terrible thing by betraying a boy who trusted me. I'm glad you're relieved, Thomas says. At least day's good for something. His hair is carefully combed back, and he looks taller than usual in a flawless, tasseled captain's uniform. He touches my arm with one gloved hand. Before the murder of Day's mother, I would have smiled at him. Now I feel a chill at his touch and pull away. Day is good for forcing me into this dress, I want to say, but instead I just smooth down the already smooth fabric of my gown. Both Thomas and Commander Jameson had insisted I wear something nice. Neither would tell me why. Commander Jameson had simply waved a dismissive hand when I asked her. For once, Aparis, she said to me, do what you're told and don't question it. Then she added something about a surprise, the unexpected appearance of someone I care very much about. For an illogical moment, I thought she might mean my brother, that somehow he'd been brought back to life and I would see him on this night of celebration. For now, I just let Thomas navigate me around the crowds of generals and aristocrats. I ended up choosing a corseted sapphire dress lined with tiny diamonds. One of my shoulders is covered in lace, and the other is hidden behind a long curtain of silk. My hair stays straight and loose, a discomfort for someone who spends most training days with her hair pulled securely away from her face. Thomas occasionally glances down at me, and his cheeks turn rosy. I don't see what the big deal is, though. I've worn nicer dresses before, and this one feels too modern and lopsided. This dress could have bought a kid in the slum sectors several months' worth of food. The commander informed me that they'll sentence Day tomorrow morning, Thomas says a moment later, after we finish greeting a captain from the Emerald Sector. At the mention of Commander Jameson, I turn my face away, unsure that I want Thomas to register my reaction. It seems that she's already forgotten about what happened to Day's mother, as if 20 years has passed. But I decide to be polite and look up at Thomas. So soon? The sooner the better, right? The sudden edge in his voice startles me. And to think that you were forced to spend so much time in his company. I'm amazed he didn't kill you in your sleep. Thomas pauses, then decides against finishing his sentence. I think back to the warmth of Day's kiss, the way he bandaged my wound. Since his capture, I've puzzled over this 100 times. The Day that killed my brother is a cruel, ruthless criminal. But who is the Day I met on the streets? Who is this boy that would risk his own safety for a girl he didn't know? Who is the Day that grieves so deeply for his mother? His look-alike brother John did not seem like a bad person when I questioned him in his cell, bargaining his life for days, bargaining hidden money for Eden's freedom. How could such a cold-hearted criminal be part of this family? The memory of Day, bound to his chair, agonizing over his wounded leg, makes me both angry and confused. I could have killed him yesterday. I could have just loaded some bullets into my gun and shot him dead and been done with it. But I'd left my gun empty. Those street cons are all the same, Thomas goes on, echoing what I'd said to Day in his cell. Did you hear that Day's sick brother, the little one, tried to spit on Commander Jameson yesterday? Tried to infect her with whatever mutated plague he's carrying? The subject of Day's younger brother isn't something I've investigated. Tell me, I say, pausing to look at Thomas. What exactly does the Republic want with that boy? Why take him to the hospital lab? Thomas lowers his voice. I can't say. Much of it is confidential, but I do know that several generals from the war front have come to see him. I frown. They came just for him? Well, many of them are here for a meeting of some sort, but they did make a point of stopping by the lab. Why would the war front be interested in Day's little brother? Thomas shrugs. If there's something we need to hear about, the generals will tell us. Moments later, we're intercepted by a large man with a scar from his chin to his ear. Chan. He grins broadly at the sight of us and puts a hand on my shoulder. Agent of Paris, tonight is your night. You're a star. I tell you, my dear, everyone in the higher circles is talking about your prodigious performance. Especially your commander. She's gushing about you like you're her daughter. Congratulations on your agent promotion and that nice little reward. 200,000 notes should buy you 12 elegant dresses. I manage a polite nod. You are very kind, sir. Chan smiles, distorting his scar, and claps his gloved hands together. His uniform has enough badges and medals to sink him to the ocean's bottom. Surprisingly, one of the badges is purple and gold, which means Chan was a war hero once, although I have a hard time believing that he ever risked his life to save his comrades. It also means he suffered the loss of a limb. His hands seem intact, so he must have a prosthetic leg. The subtle angle he's leaning toward tells me that he favors his left. Follow me, Agent of Paris, and you too, Captain, Chan instructs. There's someone who wants to meet you. This must be the person Commander Jameson mentioned. Thomas shoots me a secretive smile. Chan leads us through the banquet hall and across the dance floor towards a thick navy curtain walling off a large part of the room. Republic flag stands are positioned at both ends of the curtain, and as we approach, I see that the curtain has a faint pattern of the flag on it as well. Chan holds open the curtain for us, then closes it behind him as we step inside. There are 12 velvet chairs arranged in a circle, and in each sits an official in full black uniform, his or her shoulders adorned with shining gold epaulets, sipping from delicate glasses. I recognize a few. Some are generals from the war front, the same ones Thomas mentioned earlier. One of them spots us and approaches, a younger official following close behind him. But as they leave the circle, the rest of the group rises and bows in their direction. The older official is tall, with graying hair at his temples and a chiseled jaw. His skin looks wan and sickly. He wears a gold-rimmed monocle over his right eye. Chan is standing at attention, and when Thomas releases my arm, I look over to see him doing the same. The man waves a hand, and everyone relaxes their stance. Only now do I finally recognize him. He looks different in person than he does in his portraits or on the city's jumbotrons, where his skin has a much warmer color and no wrinkles. I also pick out the bodyguards scattered among the officials. This is our Elector Primo. "You must be Agent Iparis." His lips tug upward at my stunned expression, but there is little warmth in his smile. He grasps my hand in one quick, firm shake. "These gentlemen tell me great things about you, that you're a prodigy, and more important, you've put one of our most irritating criminals behind bars. So I thought it fitting that I congratulate you in person. If we had more patriotic young people like you, with minds as sharp as yours, we'd have won the war against the colonies long ago. Wouldn't you agree?" He pauses to look around at the others, and everyone murmurs in agreement. "I congratulate you, my dear." I bow my head. "Such an honor to meet you, sir. It is my pleasure, Elector, to do what I can for our country." I'm amazed by how calm my voice is. The Elector motions to the young official beside him. "This is my son, Andon. Today is his 20th birthday, so I thought I would bring him with me to this lovely celebration." I turn to Andon. He's very much like his father, tall, 6'2", and quite regal-looking, with dark curly hair. Like Day, he has some Asian blood. But unlike Day, his eyes are green and his expression uncertain. He wears white Condor flight gloves with elaborate gold lining, which means he's already completed fighter pilot training. Left-handed, gold cufflinks on the sleeves of his black military tuxedo coat have the Colorado coat of arms engraved on them, which means he was born there. Scarlet waistcoat, double row of buttons, he wears his Air Force rank first, unlike the Elector. Andon smiles at my lingering gaze, gives me a perfect bow, then takes my hand in his. Instead of shaking my hand like the Elector did, he holds it up to his lips and kisses the back of it. I'm embarrassed by how much my heart leaps. "Agent Iparis," he says. His eyes stay on me for a moment. "A pleasure," I reply, unsure of what else to say.
"My son will run for the Elector's position in late spring."
The Elector smiles at Andon, who bows.
"Exciting, don't you think?"
"I wish him great luck in the election, then, although I'm sure he will not need it."
The Elector chuckles. "Thank you, my dear. That will be all. Please, Agent Iparis, enjoy yourself tonight. I hope we have a chance to meet again."
Then he turns away. Andon follows in his wake.
"Dismissed,"
the Elector calls as he goes. Chan ushers us out of the curtained area and back to the main ballroom. I can breathe again. 1 a.m., Ruby Sector, 73 degrees Fahrenheit, indoors. After the celebration ends, Thomas escorts me back to my apartment without saying a word. He lingers for a moment outside my door. I'm the first to break the silence. "Thanks," I say. "That was fun." Thomas nods.
"Yeah, I've never seen Commander Jameson look so proud of any of her soldiers before. You're the Republic's golden girl."
But then he falls right back into silence. He's unhappy, and I somehow feel responsible. "Are you all right?" I ask.
"Oh, I'm fine."
Thomas runs a hand through his slicked hair. A bit of gel comes off on his glove.
I didn't know the Elector's son would be there.
I see a mysterious emotion in his eyes. Anger? Jealousy? It clouds his face and gives him an ugly look. I shrug it off. We met the Elector himself. Can you believe it? I call that a successful night. I'm glad you and Commander Jameson convinced me to wear something nice. Thomas studies me. He doesn't seem amused.
June, I've been meaning to ask you.
He hesitates.
When you were out with Day in Lake Sector, did he kiss you?
I pause. My mic. That's how he knows. My mic must have turned on when we kissed, or perhaps I hadn't shut it off properly. I meet Thomas's gaze.
Yes, I reply steadily. He did.
That same emotion returns to his eyes.
Why'd he do it?
Perhaps he found me attractive. But most likely it was because he drank some cheap wine. I went with it, didn't want to compromise the mission after coming so far. We stand in silence for a moment. Then, before I can protest, one of Thomas's gloved hands brushes my chin as he leans in to kiss me on the lips. I pull away before his mouth can touch mine, but now his hand is around the back of my neck. I'm surprised at how repulsed I feel. All I can see standing in front of me is a man with blood on his hands. Thomas gives me a long look. Then, finally, he releases me and moves away. I can read the displeasure in his eyes.
Good night, Miss Paris.
He hurries away down the hall before I can respond. I swallow. I certainly can't get in trouble for staying in character while out on the streets, but it doesn't take a genius to see how upset Thomas is. I wonder if he'll act on this information, and, if so, what he'll do. I watch him disappear, then open my door and slowly step inside. Ollie greets me enthusiastically. I pet him, let him out onto our patio, and then throw off the lopsided dress and hop in the shower. When I'm done, I climb into a black vest and shorts. I try in vain to sleep, but too much has happened today. Day's interrogation, meeting the Elector Primo and his son, and then Thomas. Mateus's crime scene returns to my thoughts, but as I replay it in my mind, I see his face turn into that of Day's mother. I rub my eyes, heavy with exhaustion. My mind whirls with information, attempting to process all of it and getting jumbled in the middle each time. I try to imagine my thoughts as blocks of data, organized into neat little boxes, each clearly labeled. The pattern makes no sense tonight, though, and I'm too tired to make sense of it all. The apartment feels empty and foreign. I almost miss the streets of Lake. My eyes wander over to a small chest sitting under my desk, full of the 200,000 notes I received for capturing Day. I know I should put it in a safer place, but I can't bring myself to touch it. After a while, I get out of bed, fill a glass with water, and wander over to my computer. If I'm not going to sleep, I might as well continue sifting through Day's background and evidence. I run a finger across my monitor, take a sip of water, and then enter my clearance code for accessing the internet. I open the files Commander Jameson has forwarded to me. They're full of scanned documents, photos, and newspaper articles. Every time I look through things like this, I hear Mateus's voice in my mind.
Some of our tech used to be better, he'd tell me. Before floods, before thousands of data centers were wiped out.
He would let out a mock sigh, then wink at me.
Something to be said for writing my journals by hand, eh?
I skim through the information I've already read before starting on the new documents. My mind sorts through the details. Birth name, Daniel Alton Wing. Age/gender, 15/male. Previously labeled deceased at age 10. Height, 5 feet 10 inches. Weight, 147 pounds. Blood type, O. Hair, blonde, long. FFFAD1. Eyes, blue. 3A8EDB. Skin, E2B279. Dominant ethnicity, Mongolian. Interesting. High ratio for what grade school taught us was an extinct country. Secondary ethnicity, Caucasian. Sector, Lake. Father, Taylor Erslan Wing, deceased. Mother, Grace Wing, deceased. My mind pauses on this for a moment. Again, I picture the woman crumpled on the street in her own blood, then quickly shake the image away. Siblings, John Shurin Wing, 19/male. Eden Batar Wing, 9/male. And then come the pages and pages of documents detailing days past crimes. I try to skim these as fast as I can, but in the end, I can't help pausing on the last one. Fatalities. Captain Matthias Iparis. I close my eyes. Ollie whimpers at my feet as if he knows what I'm reading, then shoves his nose against my leg. I keep a hand absently on his head. I didn't kill your brother. That's what he told me. But you might as well have put a gun to my mother's head. I force myself to scroll to a different document. I've already memorized that crime report from back to front anyway. Then something catches my eye. I sit up straighter. The document in front of me shows Day's trial score. It's a scanned paper with a giant red stamp on it, very different from the bright blue stamp I'd seen on mine. Daniel Altan Wing. Score, 674 out of 1,500. Failed. Something about that number bothers me. 674? I've never heard of anyone scoring so low. One person I knew in grade school did fail, inevitably, but his score was close to 1,000. Most failing scores are something like 890 or 825, always 800 plus. And those are kids that are expected to fail, the ones who don't pay attention or don't have the capacity to. But 674? He's too smart for that, I say under my breath. I read it over again, in case I miss something, but the number's still there. Impossible. Day is well-spoken and logical, and he can read and write. He should have passed his trial's interview portion. He's the most agile person I've ever met. He should have aced his trial's physical. With high scores on those sections, it should have been impossible for him to score lower than 850, still failing, but higher than 674. And he would have gotten 850 only if he left his entire written portion blank. Commander Jameson will not be happy with me, I think. I open up a search engine and point to a classified URL. Final trial scores are common knowledge, but the actual trial documents are never revealed, not even to criminal investigators. But my brother was Matthias, and we never had trouble finding our way into the trial databases with his hacks. I close my eyes, recounting what he'd taught me. Determine the OS and get root privs. See if you can reach the remote system. Know your target and secure your machine. I find an open port in the system after an hour of scanning and then take over admin privileges. The site beeps once before displaying a single search bar. I soundlessly tap out Day's name on my desk. Daniel Altan Wing. The front page of his trial document comes up. The score still says 674 out of 1,500. I scroll to the next page. Day's answers. Some of the questions are multiple choice, while others require several sentences to answer. I skim through all 32 pages before I confirm something very odd. There are no red marks. In fact, every single one of his answers is untouched. His trial looks as pristine as mine. I scroll all the way back to the first page. Then I read each question carefully and answer it in my head. It takes me an hour to go through all of them. Every answer matches. When I reach the end of his trial document, I see the separate scores for his interview and physical sections. Both are perfect. The only thing that's weird is a brief note written next to his interview score. Attention. Day didn't fail his trial, not even close. In fact, he got the same score I did, 1500 out of 1500. I am no longer the Republic's only prodigy with a perfect score.
Day. Get on your feet. It's time. The butt of a rifle hits me in the ribs. I'm yanked out of a dream-filled sleep. First of my mother walking me to grade school, then of Eden's bleeding irises and the red number under our porch. Two pairs of hands drag me up before I can see properly, and I scream as my wounded leg tries to take some of my weight. I didn't think it was possible for it to hurt more than it did yesterday, but it does. Tears spring to my eyes. When my vision sharpens, I can tell that my leg is swollen under the bandages. I want to scream again, but my mouth is too dry. The soldiers drag me out of my cell. The commander who had visited me the day before is waiting in the hall for us, and when she sees me, she breaks into a smile.
"Good morning, Day," she says. "How are you?"
I don't reply. One of the soldiers pauses to give the commander a quick salute. "Commander Jameson," he says. "Are you ready for him to proceed to sentencing?" The commander nods.
"Follow me, and please gag him if you don't mind. We wouldn't want him yelling obscenities the whole time, would we?"
The soldier salutes again, then stuffs a cloth into my mouth. We make our way through the long halls. Again we pass the double doors with the red number, then several doors under heavy guard, and still others with large glass panels. My mind whirls. I need a way to confirm my guess, a way to talk to someone. I'm weak from dehydration, and the pain has made me sick to my stomach. Now and then I see a person inside one of the glass-paneled rooms, cuffed to a wall and screaming. I can tell from their tattered uniforms that they're POWs from the colonies. What if John's inside one of these rooms? What will they do with him? After what seems like an eternity, we step into an enormous hall with a high ceiling. Outside, a crowd is chanting something, but I can't make out the words. Soldiers line the row of doors that lead to the front of the building. And then the soldiers part. We're outside. The daylight blinds me, and I hear the shouts of hundreds of people. Commander Jameson holds up a hand, then turns to her right while the soldiers drag me up to a platform. Now I can finally see where I am. I'm in front of a building at the heart of Batala, the military sector of Los Angeles. An enormous crowd has turned out to watch me, held back and patrolled by an almost equally large platoon of gun-wielding soldiers. I had no idea this many people cared enough to see me in person today. I raise my head as high as I can and see the jumbotrons embedded in the surrounding buildings. Every single one has a close-up of my face, accompanied by frantic news headlines. Notorious criminal known as Day arrested, to be sentenced today outside Batala Hall. Dangerous menace to society finally caught. Teen renegade known as Day claims to work alone. No affiliation with the Patriots. I stare at my face on the jumbotrons. I'm bruised, bloody, and listless. A bright streak of blood stains one thick strand of my hair, painting a dark red streak into it. I must have a cut on my scalp. For a moment, I'm glad that my mother isn't alive to see me like this. The soldiers shove me toward a raised block of cement in the center of the platform. To my right, a judge cloaked in scarlet robes and gold buttons waits behind a podium. Commander Jameson stands beside him, and to her right is the girl. She's decked out in her full uniform again, stoic and alert. Her expressionless face is turned toward the crowd, but once, just once, she turns to look at me before quickly looking away.
"Order! Please order in the crowd!"
The judge's voice crackles over the jumbotron's loudspeakers, but the people continue to shout, and soldiers push back against them. The entire front row is clogged with reporters, their cameras and microphones shoved in my direction. Finally, one of the soldiers barks out a command. I look over at him. It's the young captain who shot my mother. His soldiers fire several shots into the air. This settles the crowd. The judge waits a few seconds to make sure the silence holds, then adjusts his glasses.
"Thank you for your cooperation," he begins. "I know this is a rather warm morning, so we'll keep the sentencing brief.
As you can see, our soldiers are present and serve to remind you all to keep calm during these proceedings. Let me begin with an official announcement that on December 21st, at 8:36 a.m., Ocean Standard Time, the 15-year-old criminal known as Day was arrested and taken into military custody. A huge cheer erupts. But as much as I expected this, I also hear something else that surprises me. Boos. Many of the people in the crowd don't have their fists in the air. A few of the louder protesters are approached by street police, cuffed, and dragged away. One of the soldiers restraining me strikes me in the back with his rifle. I fall to my knees. The instant my wounded leg hits the cement, I scream as loud as I can. The sound's muffled by my gag. The pain blinds me. My swollen leg trembles from the impact, and I can feel a gush of fresh blood on my bandages. I almost keel over before the soldiers prop me up. When I look toward the girl, I see her wince at the sight of me and turn her eyes to the ground. The judge ignores the commotion. He begins by listing off my crimes, then concludes, "In light of the defendant's past felonies and, in particular, his offenses against the glorious nation of the Republic, the High Court of California recommends the following verdict. Day is hereby sentenced to death." The crowd erupts again. The soldiers hold them back. "By firing squad, to be carried out 4 days from today, on December 27th at 6 p.m., Ocean Standard Time, in an undisclosed location."
4 days. How will I save my brothers before then? I lift my head and fix my eyes on the crowd.
"To be broadcast live across the city. Civilians are encouraged to stay vigilant for any possible criminal activity that may occur before and after the event."
They will make an example of me.
"And to report any suspicious activity immediately to the street police or to the police headquarters closest to you. This officially concludes our sentencing."
The judge straightens and steps away from the podium. The crowd continues to push against the soldiers. They're shouting, cheering, booing. I feel myself being dragged back onto my feet. Before they can start ushering me inside Batala Hall, I catch a last glimpse of the girl staring at me. Her expression looks blank. But behind it, something flickers. The same emotion I'd seen on her face before she knew my real identity. It's only there for a moment, and then it's gone. "I'm supposed to hate you for what you did," I think. But her eyes linger on me in a way that refuses to let me. After the sentencing, Commander Jameson doesn't let her soldiers take me back to my cell. Instead, we step into an elevator held up by enormous cogs and chains and go up a level, then another, and another. The elevator takes us to the roof of Batala Hall, 12 stories high, where the shadows from surrounding buildings don't protect us from the sun. Commander Jameson leads the soldiers to a flat, circular stand in the middle of the roof, a stand with strings of heavy chains hooked around its rim. The girl brings up the rear. I can still feel her eyes on my back. When we reach the center of the circle, the soldiers force me to stand while they bind my shackled hands and feet to the chains.
"Keep them here for 2 days," Commander Jameson says.
Already the sun has blurred my vision, and the world looks bathed in a haze of sparkling diamonds. The soldiers let go of me. I sink to the ground on my hands and my good knee, chains clacking as I go.
"Agent de Paris, head this up. Check on him now and then and make sure he doesn't die before his execution date."
The girl's voice pipes up.
"Yes, ma'am."
"He's allowed 1 cup of water a day, 1 food ration.
The commander smiles, then tightens her gloves.
"Be creative when you're giving it to him, if you wish. I'll bet you can make him beg for it."
"Yes, ma'am."
"Good."
Commander Jameson addresses me one final time.
"Looks like you're finally behaving. Better late than never."
Then she walks away and disappears into the elevator with the girl, leaving the rest of the soldiers to stand guard. The afternoon is quiet. I slip in and out of consciousness. My injured leg throbs to the beat of my heart, sometimes fast, and sometimes slow. Sometimes so hard that I think I'm going to pass out. My mouth cracks each time I move it. I try to think about where Eden might be. The Central Hospital Lab, or a medical division of Batala Hall, or even a train headed to the war front. They'll keep him alive, that I'm sure of. The Republic won't kill him until the plague does. But John, what they've done with him I can only guess. They may keep him alive, in case they want to squeeze more information out of me. Maybe both of us will be executed at the same time. Or he could already be dead. A new pain stabs at my chest. I think back to the day I took my trial, when John came to pick me up and saw me being taken away in a train with others who had failed. After I'd escaped from the lab and developed the habit of watching my family from a distance, I occasionally saw John sitting at our dining room table with his head in his hands, sobbing. He's never said it aloud, but I think he blames himself for what happened to me. He thinks he should have protected me more, helped me study more. Something. Anything. If I can escape, I still have time to save them. I can still use my arms. And I have one good leg. I could still do it. If I only knew where they were. The world fades in and out. My head slumps against the cement stand, and my arms lie motionless against the chains. Memories of my trial day flash before me. The stadium, the other children, the soldiers guarding every entrance and exit, the velvet ropes that kept us separated from the kids of rich families, the physical trial, the written exam, the interview more than anything. I remember the panel that questioned me, a group of 6 psychiatrists, and the official who'd led them, the man named Chan, who had a uniform adorned with medals. He asked the most questions. What is the Republic's national pledge? Good, very good. It says here on your school report that you like history. What year did the Republic officially form? What do you enjoy doing in school? Reading. Yes, very nice. A teacher once reported you for sneaking into a restricted area of the library, looking for old military texts. Can you tell me why you did that? What do you think of our illustrious Elector Primo? Yes, he is indeed a good man and a great leader, but you are mistaken to call him those things, my boy. He's not a man like you and me. The correct way to address him is our glorious father. Yes, your apology is accepted. His questions went on forever. Dozens and dozens of them, each more mind-bending than the last, until I couldn't even be sure why I answered as I did. Chan wrote notes on my interview report the whole time, while one of his assistants recorded the session with a tiny microphone. I thought I'd answered well enough. At least, I was careful to say things that I thought would please him. But then they led me onto a train, and the train took us to the lab. The memory makes me shiver, even as the sun continues to beat down, baking my skin until it hurts. I have to save Eden, I say to myself over and over again. Eden turns 10, in 1 month. When he recovers from the plague, he'll have to take the trial. My injured leg feels like it could burst right out of my bandages and swell to the size of the roof.